Lecture 18. Last lecture on the state and politics. Next week, we launch into the mysterious world of ideology and consciousness. We go from one interesting topic to another. But now let's deal with the democratic capitalist state. So I think this might have even been in the syllabus. I may have quoted framed this problem in terms of this grand puzzle in the Marxist tradition. The basic puzzle in the Marxist tradition is, how can you have a state which is even remotely democratic function in the context of severe class division and function in a way which is actually stabilizing and good for capitalism? So Marx, this is a famous quote, I believe I give this quote in the syllabus as well. I rarely quote Marx, but this is a good occasion. So Marx wrote in his book, The Class Struggles in France, the following: "The comprehensive contradiction of this constitution," meaning the bourgeois democracy, "the comprehensive contradiction of this constitution, however, consists in the following. The classes whose social slavery the constitution is to perpetuate, the proletariat, the peasantry, the petty bourgeoisie, it puts in the possession of political power through universal suffrage. And from the class whose old social power it sanctions, the bourgeoisie, it withdraws the political guarantees of this power. It forces the political rule of the bourgeoisie into democratic conditions, which at every moment help the hostile classes to victory and jeopardize the very foundations of bourgeois society." Now that's a pretty clear statement that the democratic form of the capitalist state is really contradictory and explosive. And it's not a prediction that this is going to be one of the most successful stabilizing devices for the future of capitalism. 60 years later, Lenin writes in his book On the Eve of the Russian Revolution, The State and Revolution, that parliamentary democracy was, quote, "the best possible shell for the perpetuation of bourgeois rule." So it's hard to find quotes that are as opposed to each other. There's no way you can read that Class Struggles from France and say, deep down, what Marx is saying is that the best possible form for bourgeois rule is the parliamentary democracy. Okay, so one possibility is that just the world had changed, that Lenin had more information than Marx. But another is that they're both right, that democracy is a contradictory and yet successful shell for capitalism, that it has a double character to it, that it is contradictory and that there are historical moments where those contradictions become very explosive, but there are also long periods where the way in which conflicts get organized under democratic rule renders those conflicts less threatening to capitalism than they might otherwise be. So the question then is how to unpack this problem. And I find the work of Adam Szaworski really the most interesting on these questions. His name is pronounced Szaworski, so P-R-Z-E-W is just Sha. Szaworski. There's a kind of silent P that you sort of imagine you're saying, Szaworski. So I think there's a kind of whisper of that P there somewhere, but it's basically Szaworski. Dimitro can probably say it with more.
My said it right, K-H-U, like Kutki, but it's red Kutki.
So let me give you the way I reconstruct his general model, the way he thinks about this problem. So this will be of particular interest to those of you who are political sociologists and more generally wanting to understand the difference between conventional political sociology of electoral politics and the kind of political sociology of electoral politics that Schaborsky is playing with. So this little diagram reflects my characterization of his general model. And then I want to I'll lay out his very specific claims about how electoral politics, and particularly how social democratic electoral politics, function in a way that stabilizes rather than disrupts capitalism. So here's the big idea, I think, around the general model of electoral politics. Schaborsky insists that a theory of voting cannot be reduced to a theory of voters. The big mistake of most political sociology is they treat the sociology of voting as if it was a sociology of voters. So the typical way in which studies of voting take place is you ask people, who are you going to vote for, or who did you vote for, and then you look at all the attributes of those persons and you try to predict an individual's voting choice on the basis of their attributes. So the essential model is people have individual attributes and this explains how they vote. And the debates then are over things like, how important is gender relative to class? Has religion as a attribute of persons that affects their voting increased or decreased as a variable? So you have a vector of variables. They have variable impact on the likelihood of people voting one way or another. And the essential problem statically is to predict voting behavior on the basis of the attributes of persons. And the central problem dynamically is to explain the change in the weights. So one big debate that's been going on for the last 25, 30 years is over the declining significance of class in voting. That it used to be the case that class in most countries was a pretty good predictor of how people voted, and in variable ways that's declined in different places. So there's a big and lively and, you know, somewhat interesting at times debate in political sociology and political science over whether class matters less now than it used to. Well, Schaborsky does not deny that individual attributes might help explain why individuals vote the way they do, but he's saying that's not the core of the problem of voting. And that's because the core of the problem of voting cannot be thought of as an individualistic issue of how people's preferences are translated into their behavior. Rather, the core of the problem of voting centers on the strategies of parties. And the strategies of parties are prior to the choices of voters. One way of thinking about it is that the strategies of parties determine what the available choices for voters are. And the strategies of parties shape how people think about those alternatives. So he starts by saying, how do we explain the strategies of parties? And his answer is, the strategies of parties are a complicated process. They don't just come out of thin air. They're shaped by the nature of the class structure in which those parties operate. So parties live in an environment of social structures and class structures. Class structures impose limits on possible strategies of parties. The strategies of parties shape the ways in which individual attributes affect voters' choices. So the connection between attributes and choices is shaped by the strategies of parties. And the resulting votes of voters feeds back to affect the strategies of parties. So that's what this little diagram illustrates. Class structure imposes limits of strategies of parties. The strategies of parties mediates the relationship between attributes and voting patterns. And voting patterns select the strategies of parties over time. And this is a recursive system. It occurs over time. As class structures change, the strategies of parties operate under different limits. As strategies of parties change, it affects the ways individual attributes affect patterns of voting. And as patterns of voting change, that in turn affects the strategies of parties. So that's the kind of general abstract model. Now let's apply this model to the specific question that Chavorsky so creatively addresses. How do we understand social democratic and socialist parties and elections? There's a few chapters in Capitalism and Social Democracy discusses voting issues. If you're really interested in his models for this, the book-length version on that specific problem, which is called Paper Stones, is really a fantastic book. I mean, it's, you know, my dissertation advisor when I was a first-year graduate student told me that the key task when you're a graduate student is to find a book you wish you had written and then learn what you have to learn to be able to write such a book. Right? So what you should all be on the lookout is for books that you wish you had written or articles that you wish you had written. And then treat those as models and figure out, what do I have to do to be able to do that kind of thing? Well, Paper Stones is a book I would have loved to have written. I think it's really a brilliant empirical piece of work that that combines serious theoretical thinking with clever operational choices to be able to play it out empirically, and then really interesting empirical work. Like David James's dissertation on sharecropping, which has never been turned into a book. If it had been turned into a book, it's a book I wish I would have written, because I should get an email campaign. Have all the students in the class send an email saying, "God, we read your article, and Eric keeps saying what a shame it is you haven't written." Okay, so let me then tell you how Chavorsky plays this out. It's really interesting. Capitalist parties operate within a structural environment, not of their choosing. They operate in the context of, on the one hand, a class structure, which determines what proportion of the potential electorate are workers, what proportion are middle class, what proportion are petty bourgeois, what proportion are unemployed, etc. So they live in an environment of a class structure which distributes people and their interests in particular ways. And they live in a political environment where there are rules of the game for contesting elections. These are the two critical environments of parties. There's a third critical environment of the parties, which I will come back to, because it helps to explain the actual mechanisms that Chavorsky talks about, and that's culture. But I think one should think of it more as kind of political memory, people's knowledge and memory and beliefs about the political behavior of different parties and groups. How do the actors think themselves about the strategies of parties? But let's put that one to the side for the moment. What Chavorsky argues is that there are three nested dilemmas which parties face. And in each instance, he says, the way to think about this is, I mean, this isn't exactly his words, but let's imagine that we are collectively the central committee of this party, and we are trying to figure out what should we do, what's to be done, what should our strategy be. And we face a series of dilemmas. And a dilemma means you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, right? That there's a trade-off. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You know, you have a choice, and each choice brings perils and risks. It's not as if there's an unambiguous choice which gives you the best thing to do. Now, you may decide, all things considered, one choice is better than another, but that choice does not come without costs. So you give up something with each choice you make. You have three nested dilemmas. We're the central committee. And these nested dilemmas are the things not of our choosing. So we make choices, but under conditions not of our choosing. Famous Marxian phrase, people make history, but not just as they choose. Well, this is the not just as they choose part. And the way to think about it is the not just as they choose part is about dilemmas. It's about trade-offs. That's what you don't get to choose. You don't get to choose whether or not you face the dilemma. All you get to choose is which of the bad options you pick. And these are nested. There's a sequence. The first question you have to ask is, are we going to participate in these bourgeois electoral institutions at all? And every political party faces that choice. Once you have electoral democracy, a political party can say, this is bourgeois. If we participate in this, in these elections, we're going to be sucked into the system. We're going to be reinforcing the legitimacy of elections. If we play this game, we are going to lose our revolutionary edge, because if you're going to play the game, you've got to play it by the rules. We're not going to have anything to do with it. We're going to remain pure and be an extra parliamentary party. That's one choice. But other comrades on the Central Committee say, but comrade, if you do that, you're going to become irrelevant and marginal. And other parties are going to contest for the votes of workers. And those other parties are going to promise to deliver them some benefits. And when they get elected, they'll deliver the benefits. And we're going to just look like we're on the sidelines. Comrades, we have to participate for better or worse. It is only through participation in the capitalist democratic process that workers can redress their past exploitation. That is the vehicle and the trade union movement, you know, the two vehicles by which workers can do something about the conditions of material deprivation and exploitation inside of capitalism. So long as they're in capitalism, there's two ways they can do it. They can do it through the labor movement, contesting within labor market and within firms, and they can do it in the political arena, contesting in elections. The pursuit of short-run interests forces political parties to decide, are they going to play that game and participate in the improvement of conditions for workers in the world as it is, or are we going to refuse to do that, but in the end risk becoming marginal, becoming irrelevant to the interests of workers? The dilemma is that if the party opts for keeping out of the arena, it's opting for a lower capacity to deal with the immediate interests of workers. Now, if you really believe the electoral arena is a 100% sham in which you never, by virtue of participating, can actually address any immediate interests of workers, then there's no cost to not participating because there's no gain from participating. You don't get marginalized from a process in which, if the process never is able to deliver any benefits. And that was a reasonable view of socialist parties at some points and in some contexts. But in general, it's one of the things about electoral democracy is that winning elections matters. It may not matter for changing the world, but it does matter for the possibility of delivering some benefits. Okay, so the first dilemma, should we participate or not? We finally came, after many hard-fought debates on our central committee, we finally decided, all right, we're going to contest elections. We're going to enter the electoral arena. We bumble about the first election that doesn't go so well. We don't have any skills about it. But gradually, we hone our electoral ability, and we begin to actually get some voters on our side. We then face the second dilemma, which is, well, how are we going to contest elections? Whose interests are we going to try to appeal to? How do we define our electoral base? The working class, Shavorsky argues, is not an absolute majority in any capitalist country. Now, we can debate that because of how we want to define the working class. What he really means is that the core of the working class, with clear and unambiguous homogeneous interests with respect to the way capitalism functions. And that's basically, in his view, relatively less skilled manual labor. That is, they don't have credentials that give them a different kind of stake in the labor market. They don't have any special privileges in production. just ordinary kind of core workers. That's not a majority anywhere. To win elections, you need 51%. That's the way elections work. You know, there are special circumstances with first-past-the-post elections. If you have multiple parties running, you can win with 40%, with 35% because of the way it works. But basically, to win control over city councils and state legislatures and national governments, you need to be getting towards a majority. So here's the dilemma. Since the electoral game is a game of numbers, this implies that socialist electoral parties will have to make appeals to other classes outside the proletariat in order to win elections. And that's particularly true because there's no way you're going to win 100% of the vote in the working class. Workers are going to be voting for other parties for all sorts of reasons, particularly if, for example, there's a Catholic party here in Germany and the Christian Democrats are running. There's some workers who are going to vote as Catholics, and there'll be some workers that will vote as Bavarians, and some who will vote as workers. So you're not going to get 100% of the working class. The question is, do you appeal or do you not try to appeal to other classes? What this means that you have to decide whether your party platform is going to be a pure working class platform that's going to push for policies that are strictly in the interests of workers, or whether it will be a multi-class platform or a populist platform or a clean government platform that will appeal to the interests of voters whose interests are not congruent with the working class. In order to function as a vote-getting party by attracting allies, a vote-maximizing party, if that's what you want to do is maximize your vote, the party has to dilute its function as a pure class party. And that's then the second dilemma. Do we really maintain ourselves as a socialist working class party serving the interests of the working class as our exclusive identity? Or do we attempt to become a broader party of the people? This creates a dilemma. In Szaborski's words, hence class-based electoral parties can neither limit their appeal to the working class and win elections, nor can they universalize their appeal without losing the votes of workers. Now that last point is the crucial one, which makes this a dilemma. And this is Szaborski's argument, that if the party becomes a multi-class party trying to appeal to just the people, it will weaken its capacity to mobilize workers. Now, weakening its capacity to mobilize workers, that means on the margin. So the party has already mobilized 25% of workers. It hasn't mobilized 75%. The rate at which it will mobilize additional workers, Szaborski argues, will be lower if it dilutes its class appeal. And the reason is that it will cease to be contributing to the formation of working class identities of those workers. And workers who are not voting for the party will therefore be more available to be recruited by the Bavarian Party or the Catholic Party. That is, their identities will be mobilized on non-class grounds to the extent that the Socialist Party ceases to mobilize voters on class terms. That particular argument is, of course, debatable. You know, it's an empirical question. Is it the case that your ability to mobilize workers goes down if you cease to appeal to them as workers? It could conceivably go up if you cease to appeal to them as workers. It may be that appealing them as workers is not the way to appeal to them as to vote for your party. But Szaborski's argument is that the class character of your party will be eroded by the dilution of your identity as a party of the working class. And that in the long run, it means that the class density of your constituency will be less dominated by workers, and your party program is going to have to increasingly be concerned with non-working class interests. So that even if many workers continue to vote for the party, the robustness of their attachment to the party will be weakened when the party ceases to be a party of the working class. That's the second dilemma. Now, one way of visualizing that dilemma is what I've pictured in this first graph, the second graph here. I like to refer to Shvorsky's argument as defining what could be called Gramsci bounds on the vote. The upper bound is the maximum vote a socialist party could obtain by consistently pursuing the vote-maximizing strategy. So if the party election after election tries to maximize its vote over time, it will hit that vote-maximizing limit. The lower bound is the vote obtained by pursuing a strategy which maximizes the purity of the working class vote base. So that's the hard-hitting class politics strategy. That will maximize the working class density of its vote, but not maximize its total vote. So its electoral base will have the highest, will have a higher proportion of the votes being from the working class, but the total vote level will be lower. The vote maximizing strategy gives it a higher total vote, but the class density of its working class base is lower. Those boundaries are not up to it cannot choose what those bounds are, but it can choose its strategy. And so I've just given an illustration of a party which for a period of time was a militant working class party, that it was mobilizing heavily in working class neighborhoods on working class themes. It then shifts its strategy to the vote maximizing strategy, and therefore its vote has this sudden jump. Shvorsky then, in his empirical work, models this. He does formal modeling. He has some computer simulations with different parameters. You know, the bounds, the upper and lower bound, are estimated on the basis of data about class structure, and those bounds change over time because the working class as a proportion of the labor force changes over time. So the bounds, these limits change over time. And then he can look at how the actual vote for socialist parties varies within those limits, and then look at the actual programs of the party and see if the leaps from the lower bound to the upper bound correspond to changes in the party program, from a more strictly socialist pro-working class program to a cross-class program. Yeah.
So he was writing about Poland and Germany and Western Europe?
Was it Poland or was it Sweden? I don't know if it was Poland.
So it's
Was it Poland? I don't remember.
I guess my question is, does this apply to first past the post, one take all electoral systems as much? Because it just seems like it would be really different when you have kind of a representation of small segments of the Green Party gets 5%, they'll get 5% of the representatives.
So
then your strategy would be really different.
Right. So whether the strategy is one of forming coalitions after elections or before elections is affected by that kind of issue. So the first past the post system with proportional representation systems, which gives you many more parties that are viable, it means that governments get formed by coalitions. That enables a party to remain a pure class party and still participate in government, if it can form coalition partners. It still is the case that the party might be able to get larger numbers of votes by diluting its own class appeal, and therefore being in a better position to form a be part of a coalition government, since smaller parties are typically less attractive coalition partners, except under very special circumstances. So, of course, the details of this will vary. I think Shavorsky's core point, and the part that's relevant for the level of we're discussing it here, is that the dilemma is real, regardless of the details about how you can navigate it. So the trade-offs may not be as sharp in some electoral systems than others, and they won't be as sharp in some class structures as others. The bigger the working class, the less you have to appeal to non-working class populations in order to increase your vote. There's also, and this is getting to back to the cultural point that I just briefly mentioned, there is the question of how quickly do workers lose faith in the party when they start appealing to non-working class voters and therefore have to include the interests of non-working class constituencies in their program. That is, what's the kind of loyalty measure, the loyalty parameter for the working class, which affects how sharp this trade-off is. Now, basically what Shavorsky invokes is history. You know, that there are circumstances in which workers will be very loyal to a party, and therefore the party has a lot of flexibility to attract other voters without risking losing its working class voters. And other cases where it doesn't have strong loyalty, where voters are pretty pragmatic and they switch parties all the time. So that's an historical variable. It has to do with contingent facts about particular places that cement the identities of voters with respect to particular political parties. The communist parties of Western Europe, for example, had a robust core of voters for a generation after World War II. Because of the role in France and a few other places of communist parties in the resistance movements. And that meant that those parties actually didn't have to worry so much about whether those voters were going to vote for them. That exhausted itself by the end of the 60s, and those parties basically collapsed as serious, significant electoral forces in the course of the 70s. But there was that would count as a parameter in Shavorsky's equations that softened the trade-off that those parties faced. Let me just turn to the third dilemma. So the second dilemma, you navigate, are you going to remain a hardcore, pure working class party, or are you going to try to appeal to other parties? And Shavorsky's general prediction is socialist parties will, over time, tend to become multi-class parties, not just pure worker parties. And they'll do so by appealing to all sorts of interests that are general civic interests or system interests, but not specifically narrow working class interests. A classic example is clean government. You know, we're the party of clean government. In the United States, this was referred to as sewer socialism. The American Socialist Party was accused of sewer socialism, meaning they ran on municipal platforms of providing paved streets and sewers and lighting. The Milwaukee Socialist Party won the control over the city council in 1916, and it won the mayor city council in 14 and the mayor in 16. It had a socialist mayor for 30 years. And it was because they ran on a good government civic infrastructure program. They were one of the political forces in Milwaukee during what's called the Progressive Era in Wisconsin, which was a period when Wisconsin was leading the nation in state and local progressive politics. And the Socialist Party played a very big role in that, in Milwaukee especially. And the argument around the Milwaukee case, so there was a grad student here, Rui Teixeira, in the 80s, sort of took this course, read Shavorsky, and then wanted to see what happened in Milwaukee, did a Shavorskian analysis. And what he found contrary to, a little bit of it was contrary to Shavorsky, What he did find is that when the Socialist Party first entered electoral politics in the 1890s, for the first three elections, it was gung-ho, pro-working class, none of this civic nonsense, you know, just socialism, 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 and it got 5-10% of the vote. When it shifted to let's improve the city, let's do all these civic improvements, that's when its vote improved. What the non-Shavorsky finding is, its appeal to workers shot up as well. So it wasn't that it made it harder for it to recruit working class voters. It made it easier to recruit working class voters as well as non-working class voters. And Teixeira's argument was that it made it easier to appeal to working class voters because they wanted to back a winner just like anybody else. And once the party appealed outside the working class, that's what convinced workers that the party had some chance of winning. And therefore, they started voting for it. So that is an additional dynamic. But it still is the case that the dilution of its class appeal is what enabled it to, its class politics is what enabled it to begin to win elections. Well, then you get the third dilemma. So the first dilemma is, should we contest elections? Okay, we're going to do that. Right, Central Committee? Second decision is, how are we going to contest elections? Let's try to win elections. So we have to appeal to mass voters, not just workers. The third dilemma is, what happens if, God forbid, we win an election? Then the question is, what are you going to do in power? And there the basic choice is, do we attempt, once we have control of the machinery of the state, do we attempt to legislate and implement policies that are genuinely socialist? That is, that challenge capital, that attempt to socialize the means of production, and to shift power within the economy from capital to labor. Do we do the bunch of things that would be considered still reforms, because you're doing it, you know, you're not... it's not a revolution yet, but it's ruptural in the sense of you're passing a bunch of laws which are directly implementing, in some sequence, the elements of a socialist alternative to capitalism. Well, here the dilemma is this. Do you want to win the next election or not? How many elections are you going to be satisfied with? Well, to actually implement socialism is going to take a long time. It's not a one, it's not a four-year proposition. So you know that if these policies are going to be instituted and sustained, they're going to have to last for, you're going to have to stay in power for more than 4 years. You have a longer time horizon that you have to stay in power. All these other parties are denouncing you, saying you're going to ruin the economy, that life is going to be worse under you. That's the environment in which you are engaged in policies. So you can do one of two things. You could start launching the socialist project right away, or you can say, we have to calm things down, we have to create some economic stability, we have to convince people that we can manage the economy. But that means we have to strengthen capitalism, we have to make capitalism work well. Well, that goes against the idea of launching socialism. So you say, damn it, we finally, after 40 years in the wilderness, have won an election. The whole point was to institute socialism. Let's go for it. So you start legislating all these socialist projects. Well, what happens is you then kick in this transition trough problem, right? We briefly discussed that before. And this picture, which comes from the Envisioning of Utopia's characterization of this argument, says that there will be a period in which things are going to get worse if you decide to launch a socialist program. If you ran for office on the ground on the claim that you were going to make life better for people and didn't emphasize the caveat, but that's going to take 10 years and things are going to get worse first, and generally speaking, it's not a good electoral strategy to promise people life is going to be worse under our rule for a while. Socialist parties run on elections, even if they're running on a socialist platform, saying this is going to make life better. Things get worse. The parties that are critical of you are saying, I told you so. This is how it's going to be. For a period of time, the predictions of the socialism pessimistic path, which is what the bourgeois parties are claiming, and the trajectory of the transition trough look the same. They're both going down. And you're approaching the second election. Well, what happens? Well, what Szymborski says is that if you embark on a socialist ruptural strategy and you're operating in a bourgeois democratic environment of competing parties that can denounce you without being shot, you know, and are in full competition, you won't survive the next election. You won't survive the next election, particularly because your class base is heterogeneous. It had to be in order to get elected. And what will happen is that the middle class voters are going to defect first. And so you lose the next election. To avoid losing the next election, then you don't, in fact, launch the socialist project. You launch a reform project to make capitalism work better, and to make capitalism work better in ways that could make life better for workers as well. That is, by insurance strategies. And that's basically what social democracy does. The core of social democracy is reducing the risks of life under capitalism through social insurance of different sorts. That plus the provision of public goods. And public goods, certain kinds of public goods are also a kind of insurance issue. It means that the quality of your life isn't as dependent as on your position in the capitalist process. So if you have public goods of good universal health, that means your access to health doesn't depend upon how successful you are in capitalist labor markets. It's guaranteed independently. So that's why a public goods aspect is also a kind of insurance aspect. And that's the reason why in the end democracy stabilizes capitalism. Because once the game is in play, parties which might be oppositional to capitalism and which are committed to working class interests initially decide they have to compete in the electoral arena, otherwise they risk being marginalized. Once they compete in the electoral arena, they realize if we're going to be successful, we're going to have to broaden our appeal. So they become class heterogeneous. And then once they win elections, they realize in order to stay in power, we have to improve things now, not just in a longer term time horizon. And that means we need to have a robust capitalism in order to fund the social insurance and the welfare interventions and the public goods, which will make life better for people. That's much easier to do when you have a thriving capitalism than when you have a stagnant capitalism. So a stagnant capitalism makes it hard to provide the well-being for people under capitalism, but it still doesn't avoid the problem of losing the next election if you launch a rupture because of the transition trough. Those dilemmas are given by the system, and that's what makes it possible for democratic forms to end up stabilizing things rather than making everything get out of control. And why Marx's expectation turns out not to be right, because Marx didn't understand, it's understandable why he didn't understand how these dynamics would play themselves out. And it's 12 o'clock. So I think we should wrap this up. On Tuesday, if you have follow-up questions on this democracy theme, just remind me if I forget to say, does anybody want to have follow-up questions? I think Sadie's group's reminding me that was meant to be part of our protocol is good. So I think we should try to begin the next session on those terms. See you next week. And I will be having office hours next Tuesday.